This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN?
Oh,
what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits: enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform: Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
You're listening to iFanboy's Booksplode, Asterios Polyp.
Of Booksplode, iFanboy's exploration of a single volume, a single work of comic book wonder. That might be landing on a little thick. I am Josh Flanagan. I'm here with Ron Richards.
Hello.
Paul Montgomery.
Hey, gang.
And I think that somewhere back there is Connor Kilpatrick.
I am here, still. Oh,
no. It's a packed studio tonight, isn't it?
Always lurking in the shadows.
Always. He's not kidding about that.
Always.
We're here this week to talk about Asterios Polyp by David Mazzucchelli. This book was our iFanboy Book of the Month for September, and normally what we do is we'll do a little segment. We'll do, you know, 8, 10, 12 minutes on the regular Pick of the Week podcast and talk about the book, but we all wanted to talk about it probably a little longer than that and a little more in-depth, so we thought we'd do this a little special this time, give it a little extra time, and so here we are. Everybody here has read it, I assume. That would make sense.
No, what?
I pretended to. I nodded my head when you talked about it.
What's funny is that for me, when it's time to pick the book of the month, that's the time to go running. It's like, oh,
This is a huge, like, and right after you pick it, like, there's no pressure for like 2 months. It's fantastic. But it wasn't very hard this time out. In July, as we know, July was the greatest month of comics in Lord
ever.
How long? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, we had last month, it was The Hunter by Darwin Cook, and The Embarrassment of Riches is the Mazzucchelli book that came out at about the same time. For me personally, it's funny because Dave Mazzucchelli, I really only know from Batman Year One. That's basically all that I've ever read that he's done. But I've known for years that he's a genius, and he's, as I understood it, somewhat reclusive about the whole thing, and wasn't doing regular comics anymore. And that's about all I knew. And then all of a sudden, one day on Twitter, I start hearing these two words, Asterius Polyp, Asterius Polyp, and I had no idea what it was. And then I realized it was this book that sort of came from out of nowhere that everyone was going nuts over. And it was kind of fun because I had no preconceived notions. I had no idea what it was going to be like. And so going in that way was really neat. But apparently there's more to it than that, I guess.
Well, yeah. Why this was such a big deal was the fact that Dave Mazzucchelli, he, you know, made such a big name for himself in the 80s on Batman Year One. And then he did some other, you know, before that on Daredevil. And he did some other superhero book here and there. He actually did an issue of X-Factor with Louise Simonson. Yeah, exactly. But then in the late 80s, early 90s, he kind of walked away from mainstream and superhero comics and started doing more alternative stuff. He did his own kind of anthology called Rubber Blanket, which there was only three issues of, which is like in the whole underground indie comic scene is kind of heralded as this great work. And then he also did in 94, he did an adaptation of City of Glass, Paul Auster's book. And then after that, nothing. Like nothing. And he then went on to during that time period, he taught at Rhode Island School of Design, which is where he got his degree from, as well as SVA in New York City. And what I heard, I remember like in the late 90s going, yeah, whatever happened to that Mazzucchelli guy, and being told like, oh, he said he'd never do another comic. He's never going to do another comic again. And then as the 2000s went, you know, every now and then I heard, his name would come up and you'd hear, oh, he's teaching, but he'll never do comics. He walked away from comics. But then like in the last couple of years, started hearing it's like, well, he's working on something. And you know, there's a book coming. But not enough that there was any sort of hype or anything. And it was the same thing. Like it was almost like he walked into he didn't go out for 10 years. And then he walked into a party, dropped a serious polyp on the table and walked out because he won't give interviews. Like he's not doing any press for it. And it's probably, like, in my opinion, it's the greatest graphic novel of the decade. And it's just this wonderful work of genius that came literally out of nowhere from, like you said, from like a reclusive, as close to a J.D. Salinger that we'll get in comics, although I guess that's Steve Ditko. But Steve Ditko is still making comics, whereas Mazzucchelli just hasn't been. He's been teaching. So
we've learned that Ron is not afraid of hyperbole.
No, not at all.
You're trying to get a quote on the softback, then, is what I hear here.
I don't think there will be quotes on the back of the softback. That's the type of book this is. It's amazing. So
okay. Well, you know, what's funny is that I was a little leery of the book because, you know, of everything, I guess all the stuff around, I thought, I was like, I was worried it was going to be a little obtuse, a little overly, because it was like a weird, I didn't know what the title even meant. And I was pleasantly surprised to find like a story. Just a fairly straightforward story.
I was so afraid of you reading this, by the way. I was so afraid because so many people were talking about it, and I was afraid that like all the hype around it was going to – you know how sometimes that works in the opposite way?
Yeah, definitely.
Because I wanted this to be the book of the month for our fanboy because it's so good in the hyperbole again. But I'm glad that the story kind of rose through and you saw through the hype.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think one of the reasons I chose it didn't have – like the story was good. The story was fairly straightforward. But I think the thing for me that stood out the most about this book is that the whole time I'm reading it, I was thinking about why things were being done technically, why, you know, because there's different styles and all sorts of things being employed on the pages. And at the end of it, I found myself thinking about it and wondering – you know, what was happening, and not in a bad way, like I was confused about it, but it made me really think about graphic novels and comics and techniques and things like that in a really productive way, in a really good way.
On that same vein, you know, like, you know, you refer to books sometimes as clinics on comic book, you know, writing or drawing or whatever. This is sort of, it's beyond that.
It's like it's a master class.
Yeah, it's not even just how to write a good comic. It's suggestions on every possible thing you can do with the medium. And I don't, you know, I don't think Ron's being that hyperbolic by saying that it's, you know, the best, you know, graphic novel of the decade, because this is really a quintessential graphic novel. That's when I closed the book, that's what I thought about it, is, you know, when you talk about a comic, it could be, we say it's like, that's a really cinematic sequence in that book. This is total, like, there are things in here that you can only do in a comic book.
It's almost the thing opposite of cinematic.
Yeah, it's the thing that immediately struck me with this is, I mean, you could try to do some of this with animation, and I thought about, like, you know, Chuck Jones or something like that. There's some sequences where the backgrounds kind of reminded me of that, where it gets a little sort of, like, pop arty. There's the stuff with, like, the word balloons and everything, and we'll get into all the mechanics of it. But I was just really impressed, and you know, one of the things we could talk about is, you know, you were saying you were thinking about the whole time of all the things he was doing in here, and you were conscious of that. I mean, is there a level to this where you're sort of taken out of the narrative, and you're thinking so much about the composition of the book, the mechanics of it, that it's sort of a different reading experience? It's not so much about the plot or the narrative. It's about the execution of the book and what decisions he's making. And I mean, that, I think that's what it was for me, but it didn't bother me so much. Well, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and I think it's the combination of the two. It's the fact that that as I was reading this, I was just startled to see, like, those decisions he was making and his execution style, but in no detriment or in taking away from the story at all. In fact, it made the story that much stronger. And so it's one of those rare situations where the two kind of got entwined in, like, a spiral and made the experience that much better.
Mm-hmm.
For me, at least.
Yeah. So, Connor, have you had any of this Kool-Aid?
It's a tour de force in terms of art and design and construction of comics. I think for story-wise, it's pretty standard. I wasn't really blown away by the story itself. But in terms of as a comic book and how it's put together and the art and the thought to every bit of the design, it's an amazing achievement. But otherwise, I wasn't really that blown away by it when I finished it. I was kind of underwhelmed by the story itself.
Well, I think that's part of the – I mean, the story is very – I think the story is somewhat simple in that, but was also really relatable and really evocative, and, you know, and we're going to talk more in detail about specific things with the story, but, like, I keep saying, when I talk up the book to people, when I talk about it, there was literally a 7 or 9 page sequence that I had to close the book and put it down and walk out of the room, not only because it was executed so perfectly and amazingly, but because the emotions that came out from the story points were so strong, you know, and it was just powerful on both sides of the coin.
Oh. Yeah, I can see that. It wasn't for me. For me, it didn't really hit me like that. It didn't. I mean, I didn't really get to know the people in the book very well. It was more about the specific short time in their lives and how it was portrayed artistically for as people. I couldn't tell you much about either one of them.
Yeah.
Well, we'll give a short synopsis as best we can, I guess, about what it is, and then we're gonna
spoiler warning.
Yeah, we'll get more into that. Well, this would be if you're listening, you're going, I don't know anything about this. We'll sort of tell you what it is, and then after that, we are going to get under the hood, as it were. So basically, this is the story of a man named Asterios Polyp. That's what it means. He's it's his name. He is.
So it's not Red Tide. It's a guy.
You were really hung up on the title. When you read it, you were like, oh, I'm glad it means something. Like, I was never, it never was consideration for me.
It was that, like, when I saw the words for the first time, people said, I just read this. I didn't know, it had no meaning for me.
And plus, they're interesting looking words. I mean, they're not words that you ever, I mean, like, Asterios is obviously Greek, but I immediately thought of, you know, like, kind of stars or asteroid, that sort of thing.
But I don't know if it's a real name or if it's a made up name that sounds like it's Greek.
Yeah, but then – and Polyp, everybody has, you know, kind of the – I think that triggers the same kind of thing as it's, you know body, you know, physical kind of things, you know.
Colonoscopy,
exactly, yeah.
He's an architect, or actually he's a professor of architecture. He's very well renowned, but the thing about him is that while he's very respected in the world of architecture, he's designed many things, he's won awards, he's written books, he's never actually had anything built. So he's a man who exists solely in the realm of the theoretical for the most part. He's never actually done anything.
He's an intellectual.
He's very much an intellectual. And to me, that the part of the story that really most resonated with me was this idea of intellectuals and what they're like. And basically, this story takes place over two timelines. On the one, we're looking sort of in the past and about the beginning and the whole arc of his relationship with a woman that he marries. Her name is Hannah, and she's an artist. And then at the same time, it's the time after his relationship with her when he has sort of taken off on a soul searching road trip and ends up living with some weird people. Is that basically what it is?
It's about right, yeah.
Yeah, and then from there, it really becomes about getting to know these people and the techniques that he used therein. So that's basically the story. So I guess we'll go from here.
So spoilers from here on out.
Yeah. As I was saying, the thing that I think I most appreciated about this, I really liked the portrayal of the character of Bollop himself, because he's kind of he's an asshole in a way. He's very sure of himself. But at the same time, he hasn't really ever accomplished anything, but he's very quick to scoff at other things and other people, and he holds himself in a high esteem. And to be completely honest, as I was reading through it, I was like, he kind of reminds me of the worst parts of myself. I'm relating to parts of this, and I'm not like a high-end intellectual or anything like that, but you know, on my worst days, I can definitely see parts of this kind of personality, and It was very illuminating, and you see him forming this relationship with this girl Hannah, who's very sweet and very, her heart's on her sleeve, and they have a hard time getting along, and they care about each other, but
they're total opposites.
Yes, then their natural ways of being with each other don't mesh, and he ends up hurting her a lot without really meaning to. And actually, that even happens vice versa a little bit, because his ego is so great that when she doesn't placate it, he's hurt by it. So it sort of works that way too.
But he's so emotionally divested from her. Mm-hmm. I mean, he loves her, but at the same time, he doesn't actually see her ever.
Right.
Until she's gone. I mean, he doesn't really seem to notice her when she's around.
And then
is he monologuing about whatever's happening around him?
And then gets very jealous when she starts having her own kind of life and other people giving her attention and not him.
Yeah. So he's a very complex in terms of, I mean, he's sort of the apex intellectual, where he's so far in his own head he doesn't see what's going on around him until it's all too late.
Right.
And I think one of the things that really helps to make the character not so off-putting is that parallel narrative structure where we're seeing him later on, where he's sort of softened a little bit, or at least he's more – he's not dealing with as many people. So he's sort of out on his own and exploring and trying to figure out sort of what went wrong, really.
He also has no frame of reference for his former egotism. You know what I mean?
True.
Like, he's not in his world at all, and these people have no reason to respect him or give a shit about what he thinks is so great about himself. So – he's out there on his own as his own thing.
Well, and it also ties into the fact that he very much, you know, like you know, many people in this world, he's the type of person who sees the world in black or white, you know, and there's a lot of exploration of that in the book, and you know, his view, you know, whether it's black and white or my way or your way or the right way or the wrong way or internal or external or factual or fictional, to pull from the actual book, but there's very much this duality, no kind of gray area, and that's kind of mirrored by the fact that, and can we get into story points now? Have we moved on to this or?
Yeah.
Okay, he's actually a twin, and his brother died in the womb, so he's almost like half a person.
Hellblazer ripoff, really.
And there's a story element where that times in his head he's kind of having conversations with his twin, who's named Ignacio or IG, some one of those words, another weird name. And you know, and part of that, those conversations with his, you know, not existing twin is really questioning his worldview, and that's part of the journey that he takes in the story is that questioning the way he's been and the way he looks on the world, and part of that is going from the city that he lived in to this small town and the journey that he takes and the journey that eventually ends up him back in his ex-wife's, you know, arms. And so it's interesting to see how that, you know, that life journey and that, you know, worldview, you know, examining is both happening both in his head and externally, and addressing the whole kind of two ways of looking at the world, my way or everyone else's way, and realizing that really maybe he doesn't know everything.
Mm.
So
That's the central theme of the book, I think, is if you had to narrow it down to one word, I think it's perception.
Yep.
And that goes for the narrative and for the artistic styles, because one of the cool things they do, I don't know if we want to get into the art yet, but it's so central to the way the story is told that you kind of have to. But each of the characters, including Asterios and Hana, they each have their own artistic sensibility, and that's sometimes how they're portrayed, especially when they're arguing.
Yep.
So you have Asterios with the super geometric designs, and then Hana with more of a sketchy, red, like pencil,
she's
emotion,
values. She's emotion. You're emotional,
exactly. Yeah, so, I mean, you can talk about it in a lot of different ways. There's the visual representation of how analytical Asterios is with geometry, and it's all order and discipline, and with Hana, it's about emotion, so it's all value and shading and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's so interesting on a whole bunch of different levels and how it's represented, and I think even though the story is really simple, the way it's told, it's central to the way the narrative works, and part of the story you don't get unless you have the way that the characters are rendered in geometric shapes, and it's not every page that it's like that. It happens on certain sequences, so he's mixing it up the whole time. It's really, really cool,
and that's part of what makes this book so magical. And it goes back to what you said earlier, Paul, is that this cannot be done in any other medium other than graphic novel, comic book, visual storytelling. Like the words that are being spoken by the characters are as important as the way he's drawn them, the way he's rendered them, the way they're angled, the way whatever device is being used in them, and it becomes that much more of a visceral experience where you're both reading the story and watching what happens, but also seeing, and almost nearly every page and every panel is filled with some sort of subtext or representation or
the most obvious example of that is this is something I've never seen in anything, and it seems completely obvious to do, but every single character has their own dialogue lettering style. Every single one. Asterios is all squared off or rectangular, so the balloons are all right angles and straight lines, and is his the font that they use for him, and I'm sure this is all done by hand, is sort of a straight up, font, and the I don't remember the wife's name, the woman that they stay with,
weird lady,
big bubbly, voluptuous word balloons, as it were.
Even his brother Ignacio has, like that bigger font. It's much bigger and it's italics. And yeah, it's like everybody, you're right. I mean, everybody's represented by their lettering as much as the way they're drawn.
And Hana's, it looks like handwriting. It's not, it's just very casual and very, very freeform. And so right away there on every page, when anybody says anything, you immediately have some sort of clue. You may not be aware of it right away, of what they speak like or what they're like. And that's neat. That's a really neat thing.
Yeah. And also within the subtle things, is as simple as the coloring, how the book is broken up into kind of segments or chapters, and there's one in the past, one in the present, one in the past, one in the present, and the past is done in this bluish, purplish kind of tone, whereas the present is done in this yellowish kind of tone. Well, and so the
purple is present the whole way through. There's no black in this book.
Right.
There's like a dark purplish color used instead of black, but the mm-hmm. tones are blue for the past and then yellow
for the present.
Yellow for the present,
and which is such a simple device, mm-hmm. But then is just so effective because in your head you know exactly when he is.
What's funny because there's all these things that seem to be really easy to do in a comic book to very easily indicate things, but if you only read regular sort of issues in mainstream comics like this, they don't really have the freedom to use these tools for the most part.
Yeah.
Well, they have the freedom. They just don't do them.
It's true, but I mean,
everybody has the freedom to use them.
They do in a way, but like a house style would sort of indicate that for the most part they're trying to deliver a product that's mostly consistent. But they don't for the most part. This is the kind of place where these kind of things get done.
Yeah, I agree that it gets kind of done in these more kind of alternative kind of comics, but I don't think it's because of a house style. I think it's partially because of the amount of thought I think being put into this is not possibly the amount of thought that's being put into X-Force.
Well, it's like we talked about Batman and Robin, how every comic could be that good if they really wanted it to be.
Yep.
The amount of work and effort and thought and stuff put into each issue, and clearly there's more thought being put into almost, you could say, into a page of this book than most 22-page, 24-page DC Marvel comics.
Yeah. What I would love to know is how long he worked on this. That's what I want to know. Is because it's not short. I mean, it's a thick book.
Oh.
And this other thing, the other thing that I love about it, and we need to, and we're kind of dancing around, and we need to get in some of the art stuff soon, shortly. But what I love about it is that it was, you know, it's marketed as his first graphic novel, which is totally true. This is his very first. Everything is done by him, and he did everything, you know, in terms of the drawing, the writing, the lettering, the cover design. You know, every aspect of this book he created.
And even like it actually needs to be said, I guess, a little bit, even holding the book in your hand, yep, and touching it and feeling what it is. It's not like any book I own.
Yep. It's unique. The dust jacket's only part of the cover. It's right. Not even the whole book, which is also unique.
It's like a half shirt.
Yeah.
Makes me scared of damaging.
And apparently,
you know, what's interesting. It's the shape. The book itself is the shape of like a textbook.
Yep.
Like something you might be carrying around in grade school. So like you can learn from this book. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I'm actually getting the copy I bought is going to be my loan copy, and I'm going to buy a copy that's a archival copy. Mm-hmm. So because I've already loaned it out like three times, it's all ragged by now.
The cover itself is like a recycled stock, and there's no, you know how they would wrap something around the sides to stop the cardboard from fraying. That's yep. not there. Yeah. It's just sort of raw cardboard.
Yeah,
it's interesting in that way. Big, thick, heavy paper inside, and it's funny because you talk about the art as being very thoughtful, but it's not in any way overwrought. I suppose like it's fairly simple looking in its design and the pages.
Well, it's very cartoony in terms of the art, so the look. Yeah, I mean, it's by no means this is cartooning, you know.
Well, sometimes I mean he runs the gamut of art styles.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and, you know, there's impressionism. There's every style except for realism in the
right. Exactly. That's what I mean. There's no realism.
Yeah.
So. Well, some of the. I mean, I guess you're right.
I mean, in terms of the art style and the representation, it's yeah. There's no photorealistic. We're not looking at Neil Adams kind of work here. You know.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. But there's places where, you know, it leans to more. You'll see places that have lots of cross hatching. Then you'll have pages that are done. There's a couple of sort of more ambiguous pages. They're usually to end or start chapters. And there'll be just a bunch of different styles on a given page. There's one that, you know, where he's talking about, I think he's dreaming basically, and talking about what is the reality of the self and all this stuff. And like on it are just all these different sort of different ways to depict a person. And just on this one page, there's all these different little art styles from straight up illustrative to, you know, scratchy lines, and then just like a Chinese character of one, and just all these different things. And it's really neat to see when it shows up. It's not overdone, which is very helpful, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Should we talk about Ron's favorite sequence?
Yeah, I think we should.
Well, before we get to that, there was one sequence that I'm trying to find that I wanted to talk about that I can't find, and I hope I didn't make it up, and I'm pretty sure I found it. But how the use of art and the word balloon and stuff like that. And so it's a large portion of his worldview, of Asterios Polyp's worldview, being challenged or changed is in context of his marriage to Hannah and the breakdown of it, and ultimately his realization that he, you know, wants to be with her again and all that sort of stuff. And there was one or at least from her point of view, or a memory of him just saying the same thing over and over again, but visually showing how the meaning was different as it was interpreted by her. And I wish I could find the page, and I'm flipping through it and I can't find it. But, you know, I thought that was just a great use of, you know, of a subtle nuance of conversation that really you shouldn't be able to get in visual storytelling, because it has to do with the tone and you know, interpretation, but you totally get when it was done visually. But the sequence that I was talking about that knocked me on my ass was in the story, like we said, you know, we follow Asterios Polyp's life, and we see when he meets his wife and they get married, and then they, you know, he's teaching in Ithaca and she's an artist, and he's got a place in New York City, and she gets a opportunity for a job and the design job with this kind of very I don't know how to describe him. Very interesting theater-like character, and ultimately leads to the dissolution of their marriage. And you know, fast forward to the present, and he's, you know, kind of on this life journey, and he's, you know, taking a job, you know, as a car mechanic in some town in upstate New York, what I assume is upstate New York. For some reason, I thought it was like Poughkeepsie. That's what in my head. That's what it was. But anyway, and at one point, so he's living in a rented room of the mechanic that he's working for. She's renting a room from him, and he's just sitting in his bedroom, and he realizes that he has a blister on his foot. And what happens is that the whole room changes. he's in the same position, but it's the coloring has changed and he's in his position in his old bedroom with his wife. And he's saying he has a blister on his foot and this has happened to him before. But in the present, he's alone. And in the past, he was with her. And this triggers a 7-page horizontal journey through the subtlest and smallest of memories of his life with his wife. Little things that shaving her armpits or blowing her nose or cutting her hair, is along one, the top vertical strip. And then the middle strip is, an interaction when she got a bit of a Q-tip stuck in her ear and how he helped her out and how you kind of, realize, how she was thankful that he was there to help her. And then the bottom strip is, kind of a little more the rougher points of being together, being sick or the more emotional things as well. Kind of love of a cat and, these sort of kind of little moments that we all have about the people we live with. And it was just amazing how this memory of having a blister on his foot triggered this waterfall of memories and this, scrolling view across the pages just completely knocked me on my ass. So
it is my favorite sequence in the book too, actually.
Yeah, because it sneaks up on you. You don't expect it, and it was just done so subtly and quietly.
Well, it was it built too. If you look at the way that it's built, like you said, it starts with it's him on a blank page in this one position, sitting down, looking at his foot. I have a blister on my foot, and the chapter's actually like the head of the chapter. It doesn't have any words. It's just like sort of an outline of a foot with an arrow pointing to a white dot on that foot. So you see him sitting on the bed, and then they cut to him in the same position, but he's sitting in the bedroom that he's renting. And the thing about that bedroom is that it goes completely against all of his stylistic ethos that they've been talking about the whole time. He's one of those guys like who has all modern furniture, everything is clean, it looks empty, everything like that. But this place that he's staying with is a crazy woman who runs the place, and she says that like the chi of the room or whatever – So this table in the middle of the room and it's upside down and there's a chair on its side and he can't fix either of those and everything is sort of at an odd angle.
There's no parallel lines at all in that room.
Yeah, he's not allowed to fix any of it. And then he cuts back to like his bedroom and it's completely clean. There's one, thing of like orchids and like a wood block. Everything is squared off and cubed. And then it's like the panels start building. There's four panels on the first one and they're sort of randomly arranged and then seven and then more. And then as you keep building, like all the panels get smaller and more intense as if you could hear, like if it was a musical montage, the cuts would be getting faster and the music would be getting more intense or something like that. But this is a visual representation of that instead.
Yeah.
It was very nice.
I mean, it was just such an emotional kind of thing that was done so elegantly. And then to have it be followed up by the silent chapter of basically the descent of Orpheus, kind of tying back into the whole Greek mythology aspect. This is really the turning point for Asterios in the book and kind of the realization of, what he needs to do in order to be happy and to get his life back to where he wants it to be.
Now, on the last pages of this montage, are they suggesting that she had a miscarriage?
Because
that's kind of what I'm getting out of it.
Possibly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that.
I don't know. It's not really. It's up for interpretation, basically.
Yeah.
But if that is the case or if not, like I like that because you get to wonder about what it is. Obviously, stuff went on and it was significant, but they don't really spell it out for you.
Yeah. So, but I mean, and just the fact that it's the whole, the middle sequence of her with the Q-tip stuck in her ear. And the idea of this tool that they found, this Swiss Army knife that they found has the tool that they need, something that you don't plan to have. And then the idea of her having to trust him and, kind of two people working together, and just shows the power of a good relationship and kind of in a subtle little act like that, So.
Well, he uses the tweezers from a Swiss Army knife that he found. And it was like kind of odd that he'd done that anyway.
Yeah,
That he'd like kept the when he found the Swiss Army knife and he kept it. You're like, well, that seems odd. It doesn't seem like something he'd do. And it was neat to have it come back around like that.
Yeah,
I got a question. Also, my other favorite page is a 2-page spread where they're looking at the crater and he just goes, "Now that's a hole." No, I love that page. There's one thing that I found myself thinking about the whole time that I was reading it, and I don't know if I ever solved it, but Asterios for the most part is drawn in profile, his face. Which is this weird sort of upside down bell shape. and it's very symmetrical, and his nose sort of rounds out one side of the curve. And I've been trying to figure out if what that means or what the purpose of that is. And I was curious if you guys.
He was a full person cut in half, and it's sort of like we're looking at somebody in relief.
Yeah.
You know, it's like someone the twins, the whole person, was cut down the middle.
Yeah.
So we're getting his flat side from where he was cut. It's sort of like a visual representation of him feeling like he's only half a person.
Right. And that's
one way to interpret it. There's no answer.
And that could tie into the earlier in the scene when there's a couple times when they're in bed when they lay in kind of like a yin and yang kind of him and his wife kind of lay in a yin and yang kind of setting, and that would be that kind of speaks back to the half a person kind of idea and the someone completing him. It can also be I've discussed it with other people, and I was told that it's a kind of nose in the air, better than everybody kind of representation as well. So
I think that feels like it's too simplistic.
Yeah,
because that's only one aspect of his. That's the most obvious aspect of his personality.
Yeah.
So I like that it's symmetrical. I feel like that's who he is, and it's sort of immovable also, which is also who he is.
Yeah.
But there's also a big curve to it, so it's not like it's squared off like everything else in his life. Suggesting,
right.
I guess, that there's more to it. And this is exactly what I'm talking about when I was saying, like, when I was reading it, it made me think about it in a way that, like, when you read just straight text, you have to think about what the symbolism in something means. You know, well, why did a white panther walk across there? What does that mean? And in this way, you're doing that in the sense of the visual tools and cues, and I liked that a lot because it was in a way that it wasn't so straightforward that I was like, it was just a bunch of metaphors that were straight on the nose. There were things that were done very subtly that you didn't really have to know why, but if you wanted to think about it, maybe there wasn't anything, but you're sort of searching for meaning, but not in an annoying way. It's a very fine line, I think.
The best art does that. It makes you think about what it means, and it doesn't necessarily give you the answer, and it makes it so that everyone has a different answer.
And it becomes
very personal in that sense.
And it invites you to revisit it. So, I mean, you could read this like a million times and, you know, you're coming away with something every time. I mean, that's a cliche, but with this book, I think it's totally true. When you read it, I'm going to read this, you know, this is going to be one of those things I read like every year or something like that. And just pick it up and find new tricks that, you know, that he did or different themes that, you know, he's trying to get across with the art. It's just a really rewarding kind of book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it really is, and it's the kind of thing where, like, I heard all the hype too, and I went and got it, and I gave myself, you know, a good, you know, hour to sit down and read it, and not do anything else, and just focus on it, and I couldn't put it down. I read it in one sitting, aside from the break that I took during the sequence, but every chapter, you know, fell into the next one, you know, with a level of suspense. Like, I wanted to keep going. I wanted to see where the story was going, and I wanted more flashbacks. I wanted to understand more about his character. I wanted to understand more about this, you know, kind of schism between, you know, between his worldview and to see how he deals with it. And, you know, I've heard some people criticize the ending. I love the ending. I thought the ending was great. It was great. Yeah. In that, like, simplistic, poetic kind of, you know, like, you know, I don't know. I just, it a little bit of humor, you know, like, it just made me laugh.
I don't know how I feel about the ending. I don't dislike it.
But we can spoil it, right?
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about the end. Mysterious, like, fixes up a car, and he makes it electric, which is quite a feat.
Solar-powered electric.
Yeah. Solar-powered. Yeah. Yeah.
He drives and drives and drives, meaning that he could actually do real things if he wanted to. That would mean something, I suppose.
Yeah, he built it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so he goes driving, and the car dies in a snowstorm, and then he's gotta hoof it the rest of the way to where Hana lives, which is apparently on a hill somewhere, nowhere.
Yeah.
And he gets there, and they talk, and it's they're sort of making up and getting to know each other again. And he looks at her art, and he finds there's like a geometric thing to it, and he relates to her finally. And they're sitting there on the couch, and he just is like, "This is nice." And then one of them says, "What's that noise?" And then, like, you flip to the last page, and it's just a giant meteor. Headed towards the house on a two-page spread. I guess suggesting that no matter what, we're all doomed anyway.
Yeah.
But if you're gonna go out, I mean, that's a good moment to.
Oh yeah, totally. Like, you go out with no, like, everything. Like, this is nice. I you know, like, it's not unresolved. You know, like, he found his moment of happiness. You know.
But the thing is, you could have ended on "this is nice" and backed up from the house, and then at this point, the "what's that noise?" and then the two-page spread, the last three pages, basically, it's almost like yanking us back into it. Remember, this is a comic book. And so here's like a, it's almost like here's a punchline or a gag or something like that. But it's,
well, it's also, it's, right, but it's foreshadowed. I mean, it's earlier. Yeah. There's the guy talking about the meteorites and stuff in a diner. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When he ends
and
up
like
in
Ron
town.
Said, his name is very evocative of asteroid.
Yeah, but then don't. I mean, it does not end there. And then you turn the page and you see the very simple, you know, the very simple kind of representation of the treehouse that he helped the mechanic build for his kid. And you hear the kids scream, "Mommy, look, a shooting star!" And the mother and the father and the mechanic, who are having problems or whatever, are cuddling the whole their whole families together. And the mother just says, "Make a wish."
All right, you want to know something?
So,
I never saw that. I think I got to the
it stopped.
Yeah, I think I got to the I think because what I think I got to the meteorite page, and then you look at it and it kind of looks like that's the end of the book, and I don't think I flipped it again. That's funny.
That's funny. No, you know, it's perception. I mean, that's the thing. It's like for one person, it's, oh my God, we're going to die, although they don't know. And then, but you know, for this kid, it's a shooting star.
It's a wish. It's a wish and potential for the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. So
nice poetic ending, I think.
Yeah. I love the ending. I loved it. I mean, it's one of the rare books where, I mean, I can find no fault with it. I find there's nothing – this is like a wonderful work that I can hand to anybody and be like, this is amazing. Check this out. This is a great – this is a celebration of the visual storytelling method, and it's fantastic.
You preface it with that because it might be going too hard. I feel like this is the kind of book that I would give somebody and be like, just read this and tell me what you think. Like I almost wouldn't want to build it up at all.
Exactly. I mean, no, I see your point there, and yeah, and that's the kind of thing where you don't want to influence that much or whatever. But I could see that. But the thing is, I guess I take no hesitation in giving it to somebody.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, but I think it has to be somebody who wants to be thoughtful about something. I suppose from you know, if you're totally into action movies all the time, this might not be your thing.
Yeah.
Just because I think it requires an effort. In your entertainment, it's not strictly entertainment. It's entertaining. This is not a bad thing, but just you know.
Okay, I gotcha. I hear you.
I don't think it's super dense, though.
It isn't.
You know, I mean,
it's not
at all like you know inaccessible. I think even if you're just you know going in and assume and not having any assumptions about what kind of book it is, I think you can still enjoy it, and it unravels itself in an interesting way. And I mean, you can definitely follow all the different things he's doing, and especially I love all that stuff with like especially that end scene where they're talking and all of a sudden their word balloons, which had been and their stylistic you know style. And representations had been at conflict the entire book. The word balloons like wrap around each other, and they overlap. You can only do that with comics because only in comics are there word balloons.
Yep.
So it's not a compromise that you have to use word balloons to convey dialogue. Whereas you know with movies you can have them actually speak it. Like word balloons usually you know they feel like oh well I have to have it in this box and point to the person that's saying it. Here he actually takes advantage of this element and makes a complete artistic you know some kind of expressionistic idea out of it.
Right.
Which is really cool.
And then turn the page is that where they're you know they're you turn the page after their word balloons kind of tie into each other and their conversation's continuing and they're talking about you know like Hannah says why does life have to be and he says so stressful and then it ends with them you know. Kind of both saying the same thing at the same time, the idea of rest in peace, and their word balloons have now merged, and his square balloon has merged with her circular one, and both their lettering has become script. And it's the idea that you know they completed each other's sentence; they actually fit together, you know, and you know, and that's the moment where you know they can rest in peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
well, they're gonna have to.
In a fiery haze.
You know, I think that is one of the things that I was weary about this because a lot of times, like I've heard from a lot of people with you know, like a lot of indie and underground comics, like this is an amazing work and you get it and it's either completely ambiguous or it's way too dense or it's just like a bunch of metaphor that you suspect doesn't really mean anything. Whereas with this, it was pretty straightforward in a good way.
Yeah.
I was very happy with how accessible it was.
Right.
And how fun it was to read.
And I think it's interesting and important to note that and I don't know how much it ties into the Greek mythology of it or whatever, but it's you know, it's the idea of this natural kind of thing that you don't have any control over. Like his, it's a bolt of lightning that sets his house on fire that forces him to go on this journey. And then it's an asteroid that ends things, you know, like it's this idea of, you know, you can have only so much order and control in your life, but then there are these things that you don't have control over, that set you in a direction, you know, and it's a good balance between all, you know, those ideas of life and dealing with things and dealing with your relationships and the way.
In honor to what his life view was.
Yeah, exactly.
It was all about order and hard lines and geometric shapes and keeping things contained in a box. And he has to learn by the end that you can't do that, or you can't do that all the time for everything.
Right. So
I think the two great things about this book, one is the total package from an art standpoint, from everything from the cover to the from the materials used to every inch of this book is for purposeful.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the art. And two, it relates to what Ron's metaphor of him walking to the party, dropping the book and walking out, is that it was totally out of nowhere and came out and landed like a bomb. I think that was my favorite part of it.
There was no hype. We weren't waiting for it. And you're right.
Yeah. No, it's all of a sudden it was literally everywhere on everyone's lips, at least of the people who got it early and read it.
And I haven't seen that happen. I don't remember that happening in a long time.
Right.
Book just coming from out.
That's nice. You don't often get. We often talk about how there's no surprises in comics anymore.
And it was. It also like
don't surprise
it,
you
because it wasn't issues like we're used to. I guess you didn't get like a beginning part that was awesome. And then
the book like part. The book like The Hunter, we all knew it was coming.
Yeah.
You know, it was great. That didn't take anything away from it, but at the same time, we knew it was coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas this was literally out of the blue. It literally could have dropped out of the sky, landed on my desk. It would have been the same effect.
Yeah.
You know, that was a great thing about it. It's literally when you find something completely and totally unexpected, and it's fantastic. And that was one of the great things about it.
I found the panels I was talking about, and I was slightly wrong. It's towards the end when they're talking about perception and memory, and it's the shot of Hannah saying, you know, first it's four panels, and her saying it's same pose. She's saying it's just a matter of paying attention, and then it's just a matter of paying more attention, and you just have to pay more attention, and then you just don't pay enough attention. You know, that evolution of their relationship, essentially, you know, and how that can, you know, over time that can, you know, wear down on someone and explain why, you know, somebody chooses to leave.
Never paid any attention.
Yeah, never.
Not in class.
and then he loses an eye.
Yeah.
Yeah, brutal. He gets into a bar fight. Loses.
Well, there was that weird part where the ninjas show up. And
yeah, exactly. And then the video game thing when his different book.
He has to defeat Hana's seven ex-husbands. It's almost like it's almost the feeling of when Scott Pilgrim, like you first read it. You know, you're just like, whoa, this is different, and it came from.
That'd be the most similar because all of a sudden that was. There was no lead up to that. All of a sudden, it was just there, and I think
that wasn't like a whole. We still don't know how it's going to end. So I get, you know, it's a little different. That's probably the closest that I can compare it to. It was a game changer. Thank you, Robert Kirkman, for sticking that in my way of Tyrese Gibson.
I don't know. I mean, ultimately, what is the effect of a serious polyp? I don't know that there is one. You have to be really dedicated to do a book like this, and I don't know. I mean, this is not going to change comics.
No, but I think
it's not. It's just gonna, you know, it's gonna make everything else look worse in comparison. But it's not gonna. So you're not gonna suddenly get a bunch of books this well done.
It doesn't work that way. But I think that what happens is that you get creators and people who read stuff like this who get inspired by it and they use it as either inspiration or they take bits from it and it becomes a fountainhead of from where other things come. And you may not be able to draw a direct line there, but it'll exist.
Maybe. I'm not sure that'll happen, but
yeah, I mean,
certainly had other works throughout the comics that have been this good and this important that have never not changed things. So,
well, it's not something that you can really track. It's just, I mean, like as someone who kind of wants to, you know, try this kind of thing out, like, I mean, this book makes me like extremely jealous. Like, it's like, wow, this is amazing. Like it, and it makes you want to work all the more at your game and everything. So I'd hope that, you know, other creators would, you know, see this kind of stuff and be like, I really got to up my game and bring it with this because this is amazing. Yeah. So it's just inspirational. And I think any sort of landmark book is like that. So, I mean, even if it doesn't start a trend, it at least it's like
gonna,
a punch in the gut. And
it's going
like,
to light some fires.
Get your ass in. Yeah.
Yep.
So.
It's great. And like I said, I think it's I will hold it up as the greatest graphic novel of this decade with things like Parker coming very close. And I'm sure looking at, you know, the whole decade, whatever. But to Connor's point, like what its impact will be remains to be seen. So.
Yeah. So I think if you're a process junkie, like, you're gonna want to devour this. Like, if, I mean, if you've spent any time in art school, like,
it's absolutely for artists. For artists first. I mean, this is the idea of things you can do on the page, the different styles you can employ, and you don't have to be hemmed in by one style in your book.
Yeah,
using every tool you've got to express what's going on in the story. It's totally for art, not nerds first of all.
Yeah,
and then after that, it's for everybody else.
All right, everybody think they got their say in?
I think so.
Feeling good? All right, yeah. So if you want to read the written book of the month review, that's up at ifanboy.com. You can find it up at the top there, next to the pick of the week. That's all. That's going to be there for the whole month of September. And make sure you check out the rest of the website for all the cool stuff there. And if you want to write in, we are at contact@ifanboy.com.
Just go to iFanboy, look in our feed to catch our normal weekly pick of the week pick a week podcast where we talk about all the comics that come out and just the great stuff we do there. We're all writing on ifanboy.com, so it's all good stuff.
All right, well, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming in, and thank you, David Mazzucchelli, for making this possible.
Yes, thank you.